Well, they said, as their feet and then the rest of their body melted down into the sidewalk. Failing that, Jackie, simply be. Simply continue to be. And they were gone into the earth. Why did you need a ride if you could do that? Jackie sighed. She pulled the car across the street and parked it in the small lot reserved for those visiting the mayor or looking to throw themselves on the terrible whims and absent mercy of the city council. City Hall was a majestic building when it was fully uncovered from the black velvet that shrouded it each night. When not covering the building, the velvet sat bunched up on the yellowing lawn. Jackie headed through the arched entrance, not bothering to check in with the guard by the door. The guard wore a mask that blocked all sound and sight, so that he would not see anything he was not supposed to see. Even if she had tried to check in, it would have just added minutes more frustration to an already frustrating day. The only way to the mayor's office was past the doorway to the city council. She took that trip as quickly as her body could take it, scrunching the slip of paper in her hand. The doors were open, and she could see the misshapen forms and hear the predatory shrieking of the city council at work. The hall smelled of chalk and burnt hair. A new law had recently made a visit to the city council the only possible way to petition a speeding ticket. And, as a result, citizens had taken to accepting speeding tickets given to them when they weren't even in a car, when they were sitting still on a bench, or sleeping in their own bed. Better to pay than to pay, was the general feeling. She imagined running into the council chambers just then. Who can fathom the danger and pain of a visit to the city council? Of course, who can fathom an inextricable paper that binds to one's hand and unhinges one's concentration and maybe one's life? Would the city council solve the problem for her, one way or another? Would that be better, after all? From somewhere on the meeting room table, amid the chaos of council members in mid-meeting, Jackie heard a soft whimper and a loud snap, and decided to keep walking quickly. The mayor's office was upstairs, in an area of the building that was decorated with a great deal of wood paneling and framed photos of lighthouses. The mayor's receptionist was an elderly man who nodded with a smile when she explained what she needed and gestured at one of the plush club chairs lining the wall. Perhaps, at last, she had come to the place that could help her. The elderly man behind the desk gestured toward the door, and then held up five fingers and nodded again. No problem, I'll wait. She picked up a magazine from the table in front of her. 10 ways to redecorate your bloodstone circle. How to lose weight without losing sight of your own mortality. A cake recipe that only people who hate our government will want to try, so mail us your best pictures of making it and we will take you away. Boring stuff like that, but diverting in the few minutes it took the mayor to be ready for her. The elderly man rapped softly on his desk to get her attention, and then gestured with an open palm toward the door. Thanks, man. You're my favorite person I've talked to all day. He shrugged, turning back to the stairs and leaving her to the business of opening the door, which was tricky. It was one of those ones that required some mild bleeding. Ugh, she said as she entered the office. There I am, like an idiot, thinking push, no pull, and I forgot entirely to just bleed. There should be a sign or something. The mayor, Dana Cardinal, was sitting in a portrait of official grandeur that had to be posed. Her silhouette against the picture windows and the light falling on the desk, and the papers spread out amid light and shadow. It was all perfectly staged to present her authority. I happen to agree, but try to get anything done in this building, said the mayor. Sure, yeah. Didn't mean you were doing anything wrong. Yes, you did. It's perfectly fine. If we cannot be judged on our actions, then we cannot be judged. And let me tell you... The mayor turned to face her and leaned her elbows upon the desk. We can be judged. We definitely can. So, Jackie, you came to see me. Is something troubling you? Jackie sat down in the chair across the desk from the mayor and did the trick with the paper. On the floor, back in her hand, torn to pieces, back in her hand, mentally willed into flames, back in her hand. The mayor nodded gravely, not appearing surprised. Yeah, so, Jackie said, but that's just part of it. Here's something else. I'm not sure I've ever been to my mother's house. She asked me if I remember my childhood, and I don't. I don't, Dana. Jackie threw the paper in the hand-carved oak wastebasket next to the mayor's desk. The paper wad caught the rim and then rolled in. Jackie laid the paper in her hand down on the desk. I can't write anything but King City. I can't think of anything else, she said. Guess I gotta go there, but no one seems to think I should, or even would be able to do that. The mayor smiled a smile of comfort, not happiness. She looked out the window at the rapidly diminishing day. Jackie, those are all serious problems. I don't want to tell you those problems aren't serious, but I apologize if there's only so much I can do. It's a little bit hectic here, as you can see. She waved her hand to indicate the absolute still of the office. My brother's sick. We're not sure what's wrong with him. I'd love to be home taking care of him, but I have to be at City Hall. We're not sure what happens if I don't go every day. But we think that whatever it is that protects us from the full wrath of the city council involves the mayor being at City Hall every single day. So here I am, for my city. My brother has a fever and chills. He says he sees lights out in the desert. I told him we all see lights in the desert. He says no, different lights, not the same ones we usually see. Low bubbles of light coming and going. I don't know what to say to that. Low bubbles of light? Because I've... He clutches this piece of paper to his chest. Won't show it to us? Says he doesn't want us to catch what he has? Always thinking of others, even as he slips away. He's slipping away from us, Jackie. Also, the big job fair is coming up. Tents to set up, all sorts of mysterious organizations that want the best booth placement so they can trick the young people of Night Vale into disappearing or incriminating themselves, or at best, becoming part of a mysterious organization. Your brother has a paper? I'm sorry, Jackie, I didn't mean to complain. The mayor shook her head, and then nodded, and then shook her head again. No. Yes, I did mean to complain. I don't have anyone else to complain to. I'm young, Jackie. Did you know that about me? Sure. I am. I'm young, and this job is hard. I don't know if I can help you because, and I'll be honest here, I'm struggling a bit to keep this all together. But it's my job, too. I was chosen to be mayor. I was chosen, and so I will serve my city the best way I can. And that means helping people like you when they come to me for help. I'm sorry, Jackie. I'm being a bad mayor. Oh, nah. Jackie paused slightly. No, you're doing great. She leaned across the desk and held out a hand. The mayor did not take it. She continued to look out the window for a moment, her humanity and thoughtfulness tucked away inside a tight frown, an honest brush stroke in a boring painting. The mayor caught herself and set her face into something more official, less herself, a perfectly slight smile. Let's start again, Jackie. I will do my best to help you. I may not be able to help you. More often than not, I can't, but I always try. That's great, dude. Thanks. The mayor rubbed her hands together. King City is becoming a problem for Night Vale. I know there are papers in hands, and there is confusion and frustration and fear. No, not fear. Concern. There is concern. I'm not afraid, and I'm not concerned. I'm ruined. Jackie tried the word on her tongue and found that it felt right, so she said it again. I'm ruined. I don't know why King City has connected to Night Vale. Sometimes other places have a mysterious connection to our own. A little fishing town in Russia, our unfriendly neighbor, Desert Bluffs. That desert otherworld which trapped me for months. We cannot always keep the outside world on the outside. So I should go to King City? Sure. You think so? Jackie was glad for an authority that would finally tell her what she should do. Probably not. I'm not even sure if it's a real place. It could just be an idea on paper. But I spoke with, I don't know what a King City is, the mayor continued, yawning. I don't know a lot of things. I do know there will always be problems for Night Vale. There are so many. Usually they pass. Often they kill many people. But what are people but deaths that haven't happened yet? Births that already happened? Jackie said without thinking. The mayor laughed. She looked different when she laughed. And then she stopped laughing, and she did not look different anymore. Thank you, Jackie. I needed that. As for you, well, I know you came here hoping that I would have an answer or a piece of advice that would fix things. So, the mayor stood, a wordless pre-goodbye. Jackie stood too, a wordless capitulation. You say your life is unraveling. Your life cannot unravel. Your life is your life. You haven't lost it. It's just different now. Do you feel the same thing about your brother? That his life cannot unravel? That it is just different now? Dana blinked. Yes, she said. I suppose I do. Fair enough, man. But I want my old life back. Whatever my old life was. Dana shook her head. You know, Jackie, before I was mayor, I was an intern at the community radio station, one of the only interns to survive that program. Being an intern at the radio station is dangerous and terrible work. But there are days, sitting in this office, with responsibility past my years, working in a system I barely understand, that I miss my time as an intern. At least I was allowed to be young. At least I was allowed to be Dana. Not Mayor Cardinal. I hope your brother will be okay, Jackie said. He'll be what he'll be, and we'll all learn to be okay with whatever that is. Jackie said goodbye with her eyes. Goodbye, Jackie, the mayor said with her mouth. Jackie pulled on the door. It did not move. She pushed on the door. It did not move. Oh, right, Jesus. There really should be a sign, she said, bleeding. Back out in the wood-paneled waiting room, there was a blonde man with a big smile sitting at the desk. Hey? She said. Yes? He said, his voice all customer service politeness. It was not the same man as when she arrived. She did not know where she had seen him before, but the sight of him made her uneasy. Wasn't there someone else here before? This old guy who didn't talk? Oh no, he said. His smile did not waver. It's always just been me here. You have a good day, okay? Sure, okay, she said. As she walked down the stairs, he pulled out some forms, picked up a pen, and silently smiled at the forms, writing nothing. Jackie did not even flinch passing the city council doors this time. Nothing, not even the terrible council, was more frightening than the fact that no one seemed able to help her, least of all herself. 17. You didn't come home last night. Josh said this from the couch, book open across his legs. He had red claws and antennae. He was wearing baggy jeans and a Mountain Goats t-shirt, which Josh had once been kicked out of school for wearing because of its strong political message siding with those who believe in mountains. Diane stopped short of the kitchen. She hadn't expected Josh to be up already. She was running on 3 hours' sleep and had hoped to be up and out before him. "I'm here now. I hate it when you wear that shirt." "Mountains are real, Mom." "I believe in mountains, Josh. It just reminds me of how I had to come pick you up from school and wait in the front office while the vice principal gave me a lecture about how inappropriate it is to raise a child to believe in such nonsense. It was embarrassing." "Well, I'm not embarrassed by my beliefs. I'm embarrassed to be told I'm a bad parent." "You aren't home a lot these days." It was a swerve, not a response. He wasn't looking at her or his book. It was difficult to tell where he was looking because of these solid black eyes drooping from the ends of long, curved stalks atop his head. Diane walked past him into the kitchen and started the process of making coffee. She always ground her own beans. She did not feel that her coffee tasted better because of this. She simply liked the process of grinding beans. The cool crumple of the bag from the freezer, the gentle rattle of beans across the countertop, the therapeutic release of pounding them into grounds with a hammer for several minutes. As she removed her safety goggles and washed her hands, she called to the living room. "How's school?" "You didn't come home last night." She dried her hands. "I came home late last night." "From what?" "Work." "You never work late." "I did last night?" She hated the question in her own voice, but had never been good at lying. "Doing what? What were you doing that you didn't get home until early morning, and that you didn't answer my texts, and that you didn't reply to my emails?" "My phone was off." "Okay, why?" She came back into the living room, and Josh stood to face her. He was tall, his jeans draping in baggy folds over his hooves. Diane wished she knew what Josh looked like. She wished there was a single thing she could assume about her son. She wished Josh had a second parent to be ballast. Josh wished all of those things, too. "I was on a date." Josh didn't respond, so Diane nervously filled the pause. "My phone died, and I was,
You just said you were at work."
Josh tried to fold his arms, but the claws snagged on each other, and so he awkwardly clasped them in front of him. "Yes, I've been seeing someone. I know we don't talk about dating much, Mom and son, you know. It's awkward, right?" "No, Mom, no, that's really cool. What's their name?" A good lie requires two things. One, assertiveness in delivery. And two, narrative logic that cannot be unhinged by actual truth. "Dawn," Diane said assertively, achieving one of those two things.
"Dawn?"
"Yes, Dawn." Josh sat back down. "How long have you been seeing Dawn?"
"A few weeks. Mostly seeing movies and having some dinner, getting to know each other."
Diane began to panic about Josh running into Dawn and trying to talk to her about their relationship. She mentally scheduled an ugly breakup with Dawn in the coming days. Or would that make Josh even more likely to talk to her? It would certainly remove Dawn from the list of possible future friends.
"And so you spent the night at Dawn's house last night?"
"Right." She was still dating Dawn in the here and now and had to focus.
"You're not allowed to ask me questions like that, Joshua."
"You're right. Gross." She examined Josh's opaque, bobbing eyes and his flagellum-lined mandibles. It was difficult to tell by his expression if he was being playful or aggressive, but she could hear a grin in his voice. Her face relaxed.
"Yes, I've been dating a lot. I'm sorry, Josh. I sometimes don't tell you enough about what is going on with me. I get selfish."
"It's fine," he said, head tilting down, idly flipping his book open and closed. He was embarrassed by how much he needed her. At his age, he felt he should be basically independent. But as she had spent less and less time at home in the previous weeks, he had become aware of how complete his assumption of her presence had been. It panicked him a little, and that panic had come out as a demand to know where she had been. and he hated himself for demanding to know, but also couldn't stop himself from asking.
Listen, this goes two ways, honey. It's just you and me, and we have to trust each other. You're my baby.
Mom,
you're my baby. You're my pal. You're everything, okay? And that means when you close me out, I have nothing. I have a job and a house and some friends and a car and your grandparents. But also, I have nothing.
Josh swung open his mandibles to speak.
Hang on, she said. I'm not saying you need to tell me everything, but just, how is it going? How are you feeling? This can't be an easy time for you. Or maybe it is. I really don't know.
She sat across from him. There was a silence, and she let the silence happen.
You could just ask, he mumbled.
Josh, I ask all of the time. I asked just now, and I get one-word answers.
She could hear her voice getting louder and tried to pull it back in.
Sorry. I just want us to talk about our lives. Not all the time, sometimes. I promise not to get bored when you tell me about your...
She glanced down to his t-shirt.
Mountain Goats concerts. If you promise not to get bored when I tell you about the office copier breaking down halfway into my job.
That sounds boring.
It wasn't. It was R-rated for strong language and machine violence.
Josh didn't laugh, but he softened, which was all she needed a bad joke to do.
So, I'm dating Dawn, Diane said, thinking she was not at all the type of person to tell lies to her son, but once again finding that she was a different person than she thought.
Mom going on dates. Gross, right?
It's not gross, Josh mumbled. We're seeing a lot of each other, but who knows how long it will last. Tell me about you.
I don't know.
You're not dating?
No.
Josh forced a laugh.
Interested in a boy?
No. Diane didn't want to press Josh further, hoping he would enter the conversation on his own. The silence thickened the air with the hums and thumps of bodies and appliances, the coffee pot and a distant car honk, and a nearby bird exclaiming, and her blood moving in jerking, lurching steps under the skin of her neck, where she felt a slight tickle, and the faceless old woman that secretly lives in their home taking slow, careful steps on the second-floor hallway above them, and all the other sounds that silence is made of.
Why do you think I'm interested in a boy? Josh said.
Well, you're 15. I assumed all teenagers do is think about other teenagers, don't they?
No, I am, I guess. I mean, not a boy.
There was one, but he was weird. I think I scared him.
Diane kept from saying anything, worried that it might stop this unexpected moment of communication. She let Josh tell his own story.
There's a girl named Lisa who my friend Matt says likes me, but I think she's just really nice to everyone. I don't think being nice to someone means you like them, especially when you're nice to everybody. I mean, Matt just only thinks about getting with girls and hooking his friends up with girls. All these girls are in love with Matt, and he sometimes sets them up on dates with his other friends like he's a matchmaker. And they all go out with his friends just so they can stay close to Matt, but they all eventually find their way back to him. I think that's his game, setting his friends up to stash future girlfriends.
That's totally it.
That's probably why he's trying to set me up with Lisa, because he's still dating Rosita, and if I can hang out with Lisa...
Josh.
What?
He looked startled, like he thought he was alone.
Do you like Lisa?
I guess.
Yeah?
I don't know her.
Are you attracted to her at all?
I don't think so.
A little bit?
Not really?
Then don't feel pressure to go out with her. If you like her, then there's nothing wrong with it. But don't do it for Matt. That's his problem to work out, not yours.
Okay.
Silence again. Diane used the silence to scold herself for interrupting with didactic parenting. But also, wasn't it her job to interrupt Josh's life with parenting?
I hate to ask you this, Diane hated to ask, because I don't want it to seem like I was snooping.
Josh lifted his eye stalks until they were definitely opaque blackness and all, looking directly into her eyes.
I found a note in my car the other day.
Josh's shoulders tightened, and his antennae pulled back.
I think it fell out of your notebook, and it was short. Normally, I wouldn't read something that looked this personal, but I saw it and took it all in before I could even tell what it was.
This lie also accomplished one of the two things that make a good lie.
What note?
Josh knew what note. He had been looking for that note, dreading his mother would find that note, hoping he would not have to talk about that note.
Diane would occasionally find notes he had written. This had happened before. Sometimes it was actually happenstance, and sometimes the faceless old woman who secretly lives in their home would move his notes to where Diane would see them because the faceless old woman was bored and found the troubles of others interesting. Always Diane said she believed in his privacy, and always she meant it. But also, it always happened that she had read the entire note before she realized what it was. This was not a pattern that she was aware of, but it was one that Josh was very familiar with.
It was a note where you were asking your classmate about a boy you were interested in.
Josh started to sigh in relief, and stopped himself just as the air was coming out, so that it came out sounding like an exasperated huff. The note was not about a boy, but a man. Here is what it was about the note. When he was 6, Josh had asked his mother who his father was. Diane told him he didn't have a father. Some kids have fathers and others do not. Josh was one of those other kids. When he was 10, Josh had asked his mother where his father was, knowing at that age that it was improbable for babies to be born without a biological mother and biological father. Diane told him she didn't know. When he was 13, Josh had asked his mother who his father was so he could track him down. Diane told him that would not happen, that he was not old enough to go looking for his father yet. When he turned 18 and was living on his own, not under her roof, he was welcome to do whatever he wanted, but that he'd be much happier not trying to track down a man who didn't care enough to raise him in the first place. Diane did not talk much to Josh for a couple weeks after that, except to ask him what time he was coming home and whether he had homework or choir practice or a Boy Scout function. Josh was only a few tasks away from getting his blood-packed scout badge. Josh considered his mother to be a nice mother and person. She was kind, and she smiled, and she gave tender hugs, and was concerned with his well-being. Josh also considered his mother to be a difficult mother and person. She was unforgiving, and she demanded kindness back, and she killed with silence, and said sharp but subtle things that cut deeply. "You still have a lot of maturing to do," Diane had said to the 13-year-old Josh, who was one of the last boys he knew to get through puberty. He had no defense because the only thing worse to a late bloomer than thinking about late blooming is talking about late blooming. For her part, Diane did not have a good reason why she wouldn't tell Josh about his father. She didn't have a good reason for most of what she did. Mostly, she went by what seemed right in the moment, and justified it to herself later. And in this way, she was no different than anyone else she knew. There were times, like that day in the movie theater or after her speeding ticket, when she had wanted to tell Josh about Troy. But the shape of his name felt wrong in her mouth, and the thought of talking about him made her feel dizzy, like she was waking up from a dream that had been almost exactly like her own life and was now trying to differentiate the two. She did not hate Troy. She did not hate anyone. But she just didn't want to talk about him. And so she didn't. At age 15, Josh had not asked his mother who his father was. He did not want to upset her, partially for her sake and partially for his. Instead, Josh wrote that note to a friend of his, who knew some people, who knew some of the hooded figures, who knew an agent from a vague yet menacing government agency, who had full access at City Hall. And that agent might be able to get some information on who Josh's father was. Now, his mother thought it was a note about a boy he liked. She seemed not upset at all, and he wasn't going to give her any reason to be upset.
"Oh, that note. I wrote that to my friend Devon," Josh said truthfully before going on to fail at accomplishing either element of a good lie. "His cousin, Ty, goes to the new charter school on Du Bois Road near Route 800, and Devon keeps telling me that Ty's single and really cute, and I said I wanted to meet him, and Devon is like, 'I'll see what I can do,' and I'm like, 'Do you have a picture?' And Devon's like, 'Hold up, I'll get you one, but just wait. Let me see if he's interested.'"
"Did you get a photo?" Diane said.
"Yeah."
"And?" Josh was uncertain about the specifics of his imagined crush, and the lie faltered.
"Is he cute?"
Diane did not blush about her boy getting old enough to date, although she would allow herself to blush later when she was alone.
"Yeah,"
Josh said before his mind had caught up. The last thing he wanted was for his mother to ask to meet this non-existent Ty, or, worse, for her to ask Devon about his cute cousin.
"When do I get to meet him? Mom! Sorry, sorry."
And the conversation ended. They could both feel it, even though they continued to talk to each other. The connection, whatever had surfaced in the last few minutes, had sunk out of sight again.
"I'm not that interested anyway. Devon's a good friend. It'd be weird to go out with his cousin."
"Josh." She did not cry, although she would allow herself to cry later. "I'm so proud to have such a smart, considerate boy."
"Are you about to cry?"
"Nope." Diane stood up and walked toward the kitchen. She was already back to thinking about Evan and where she could possibly look next for information on him. She was tired and suppressing a nascent panic. She needed time alone, time to think.
"I need coffee, and you need to get to school," was how she explained that out loud.
Diane drank her coffee from a chipped Night Vale community radio mug she had gotten a couple years back during a fund drive. She didn't choose to donate to the station, but she had expressed her enjoyment of Cecil's show to a friend of hers. Her comments were picked up by one of the thousands of listening devices the station had hidden around town. Using a complex algorithm that measures age, net worth, and perceived enthusiasm for the station's programming, station management took a donation straight from Diane's bank account without her having to write a check, or send off an envelope, or even know the money was gone. It was a convenient approach to fundraising for everyone involved. One day, she received the mug and a shirt that had that famous Eleanor Roosevelt quote on it, "One day we will destroy the moon with indifference." And that's how she knew she was an NVCR supporter.
"Can I take the car today?"
Josh asked, trying to cash in on the goodwill he'd built this morning.
"You cannot."
"Mom, I said no.
You just said I'm smart and considerate."
"Right, I didn't say you're a good and responsible driver.
But you want me to get better, right?"
"Is that what you do, Josh? I try to have conversations with you, I try to talk to you, and we have a morning of real progress. A real breakthrough where you're kind and articulate and charming, and what's the end game? Just to borrow my car?"
Josh stood perfectly still. This was the moment he feared most. This was how conversations with his mother went. He just wanted it to be over and for himself to be out in the world where he could keep looking for his father. He wanted to understand who he was in relation to the father that had abandoned him. Had his father even abandoned him? He didn't know, and that was the point. As well as he understood who he was in relation to his mother, in all of its goods and bads. Then, seeing himself against and between these two people, he could start to figure out who he was beneath all of the forms he took every day, beneath whatever he looked like to the world in any given moment. I'm left to wonder if the only time you want to actually talk to me is when you want something from me. That's incredibly disingenuous. Mom, disingenuous means not genuine. Don't know if they taught you that word in school. I'll catch the bus. Better hurry. Josh threw his things in his bag and walked out the door. Diane stared into her coffee, knowing she had ruined a lovely moment with her son, knowing he must loathe being around her when she was like this. I love you, she called, hoping it wasn't too late. I love you too, he said back, not loudly enough to be heard. 18. Now that science and civic leadership had failed to solve her problem, Jackie sat in her car in the City Hall parking lot, unsure of what to do. No one had fixed anything. No one had been able to help her. She watched as workers rushed out of the doors to begin the long process of draping the black velvet over City Hall. It was nice to watch people struggle over a problem that did not involve or affect her at all. She didn't have to help, or act, or choose. Part of her wanted to just recline the seat as close to lying down as possible and sleep the night where she was. Stay in one spot and let the world go on with its strange and terrible business without her. But before she had even finished having that thought, she was already turning on the ignition and reversing out of the parking lot. She wouldn't stop. She couldn't. There was something in her that made giving up feel as impossible as the most impossible of her problems. Driving through Nightvale in the early evening was peaceful. There weren't many cars out on the roads, mostly just the agents from a vague yet menacing government agency starting their slow, cruising night patrol of the town. It wasn't late enough for the hooded figures to be prowling the sidewalks, looking for lone pedestrians to take and do whatever it was they did. Almost no encounters were witnessed, and, if they were, the witness was wise to cover the witnessing part of their sensory systems until the whole thing, whatever it was over. The lights were on in the various places of business along Route 800. The neon of the moonlight all night stood out as the day turned to night, a slab of mint light in the warm desert darkness, as the radio had once described it. She considered eating there, hunger being one problem that was simple enough to solve, but the thought of returning and seeing that man, the blonde man in the kitchen, smiling at her, made her nervous. Was he the same blonde man she'd seen outside the mayor's office? She shook her head, but the thought wouldn't leave. The blonde man, it said. King City, the paper said. A man in her mother's backyard, blonde hair, a smile. That was where she had known him from. Her heart was beating in her wrist, which was where it rarely beat. Dots of light studded the hazy purple of the twilight horizon. Red taillights, yellow porch lights, orange street lights, the strange greenish-white pulse of light hundreds of feet above the Arby's. In the distance, a jagged line of soft blue light, like a crack in the sky. Above all of that was the clean, white brightness of the stars and the moon and the searchlights of surveillance helicopters. Children in Nightvale grew up hearing the Doppler whir of helicopters above, recording or monitoring or whatever it is that helicopters do. It's a comforting sound, knowing that you're well taken care of by unimpeachable judges of what is good and what is evil. Jackie did not feel comforted, only inured. She was not thinking, only doing. Unaware of her car's speed, she turned off Route 800 onto an unnamed street that led, eventually, into the sand wastes and the shanty town that was the barista district. Before all that, though, the unnamed road went right by Jerry's Tacos. The light of Jerry's Tacos was the most inviting thing she'd seen all day. It was a small stand, only recently reopened after an ugly incident a few years back involving a time traveler, but already word was around that the food was worth the years of waiting and silence that had preceded it. She pulled into the lot, relieved to have so simple a task in front of her as ordering food and then consuming it. Reaching into her pocket, she added paper of a different sort and with a different kind of value than the paper already in her hand. The only other car in the lot was a silver pickup, full size, well-worn, tall, long. The windows gray with dried dirt. She had seen it many times. It belonged to John Peters. You know, the farmer? He was at the window already picking up an order of the house specialty, a mysteriously crunchy enchilada. "Hey, John," she shouted as she walked up. He turned, crunchy enchilada in hand. "Howdy there, Jackie. How goes it with pawning?" She posted an elbow up on the counter and waved away the shadow on the other side of the frosted glass that was waiting for her order. "It goes. For sure it goes. I'm just, well, taking a break, I guess. People take breaks. How goes it with, you know, farming?" "Ah, it is what it is. It's farming, you know." "Sure." A big, crunchy bite of enchilada. "Man, that looks good." She turned to the shadowy figure behind the glass. "I'll take one of those and one Jerry's special taco. How much do I owe you?" A receipt popped out from under the glass. She took a look at the price. "Really? Jesus." John Peters watched her force a tear out onto the receipt and push it back under the glass. The price paid, the food was delivered through a hatch moments later.
"Prices here have gone up a bit," said John.
"Tell me about it." They both dug into their food. When nothing else works, eating sure does. "What do you know about a man in a tan jacket holding a deerskin suitcase?" Jackie asked, not wanting to break the easy quiet of eating, but also not wanting to hang on to the question. John stopped chewing. "Have you seen a man in a tan jacket holding a deerskin suitcase?" he asked.
"Yeah, except I don't remember much about him."
"No," said John. "Wouldn't suppose you would. He has that effect on people." Jackie looked out from the pool of light they were standing in to the dark desert beyond. There was movement there. She swore that she could see the tan-jacketed man in question sprinting just at the edge of the light, more blur than person, but still with the desperate run that was away from something rather than toward. "Is that?" she asked what could only be herself, given that John wasn't looking. She dropped her food on the counter and started away from the stand, but John stopped her with a hand on the shoulder.
"Don't bother. Wouldn't catch him, probably, and wouldn't remember if you did. He's dangerous."
"Dangerous?"
"If I were you, I'd stay away from his town."
He pointed at her hand. She held up the paper. "King City?" Jackie asked. "King City," the paper confirmed.
"He's here because of Diane, I think," he said.
"Diane Creighton?"
"Don't know if he's helping or hunting her, but he certainly always seems to be lurking around wherever she is."
"Diane Creighton," Jackie repeated, in answer to her own question. she considered this information.
"Wouldn't go anywhere near that town of his if it were me," he said. "Who knows what you'd find, or what you'd find out, and then wish you hadn't."
He picked up a styrofoam cup full of horchata and took a long slurp from it, his eyes on where the man may or may not have been running.
"Mostly, we don't get destroyed," John said. "Mostly, we destroy ourselves."
Another car pulled into the lot. It was a well-preserved Chrysler from at least a couple, if not a few decades past. Out of it came a woman about which much the same could be said.
"Mom?"
Jackie said as the woman entered Jerry's Tacos. Jackie's mom smiled. She was wearing the exact same clothes as she had been that morning.
"Hello, John. How goes the farming?"
"Till we get some of that federal water here, mostly I grow imaginary corn. Grows just as well as anything else. Sells pretty well, too. Plus, doesn't take much work."
"I would not imagine it would, no."
Her mother said hello to the shadow. Jerry, behind the glass, glanced over the regular menu and, not finding anything to her liking, said the code phrase to receive the secret menu.
"I am comfortable with secrets," she said, and then did a quick scan of the proffered yellow page.
"Well, I have to say, it all sounds so good. I'll take the number 4, and I'll never tell a soul."
"Mom, did you always have that car?" Her mother looked up from the menu.
"Yes, of course, dear. I've only ever had that car. Whoever would have more than one car in their life?"
"Right. Yeah, no. I know." But why did Jackie not remember it at all?
"Have to get back to farming, I suppose," said John, standing in the open doorway.
"It's dark out," Jackie's mother said.
"Indeed it is,"
he said, shading his eyes and looking up at the night sky.
"It's completely dark out. Well, better get back to it."
He winked, tossed the wrappers and cup into a trash can, and tossed himself back into his truck. "Mom, you were saying earlier about me as a kid?"
"Yes, dear, suppose I was."
Her mother pulled some napkins from the dispenser and sat down. She didn't look at Jackie.
"What was that about?"
Her mother laughed. She kept laughing.
"Mom, what is going on? Why won't you tell me?"
Her mother didn't stop laughing. Also, she was crying. Jackie wasn't sure what to do. Her mother's food showed up and her mother was still laughing and also crying. Pausing several times along the way, Jackie moved toward where her mother was hunched at the counter, extending an arm and placing it across her mother's back. Jackie looked out the windows toward her own car. She wished she could laugh and weep, too. She felt as though everything had been taken away from her, even though only most things had. Jackie stared past her car at the dust of John's departure, swirling in the edge of light and darkness, where she could still see movement that looked like a running man.
"Diane Creighton,"
she said to herself. She couldn't hear her mother anymore. 19. Diane watches the local news quite a bit. Even when the cable is out, she watches the local news. The local news has a strong broadcast frequency, so even if one did not have cable, one would still receive the local television newscast. Even if one had working cable, the local news broadcast would come in on all channels. Or, even if one did not have an antenna. Even if one turned one's television off, sometimes the frequency is just so strong. So very, very strong. It is hard to turn off the news. That's the local news station slogan. It's hard to turn off the news. Go ahead. Try. See? In any case, Diane watches local television news because it speaks to her. It literally speaks to her. One of the morning news co-anchors, who was wearing a necktie and a coat, and who had hollow eyes and sharp teeth, and who cannot see themselves in still photographs, said,
"Diane Creighton, hello."
Diane said nothing at first, because she was eating cereal. It was the morning, and she had just gotten out of the shower before work. In the shower, she had suddenly had a thought about all the space within the walls of a house, and how much space that would add up to if it were all turned into one hollow cube. She had no idea where the thought had come from.
"Hello, Diane," said the co-anchor's co-anchor.
"Hi. Hello. Good morning," Diane replied, politely covering her face and chewing the remainder of her mouthful of Flakios, cereal made by a local company known for its aggressive and controversial advertising.
"How is Josh?"
said the second co-anchor, who wore a brown suit coat with ivory lapels, who wore their hair down, who had shiny maroon lips and nails and bright red eyes. Josh had already caught the bus to school. The day after their talk was good. The day after that day was less good. The days after those days had returned to averted eyes and closed doors. Diane had gotten some concerned calls from the school about Josh skipping classes and doing dangerous things like expressing public curiosity about the mysterious lights that pass over Night Vale at night, and trying to enter the city council chambers without protective gear. He had also been coming home late each day. She had tried to talk to him about Ty, but Josh looked annoyed when she brought it up. He would just roll his thin yellow eyes, his long ears flat across the top of his skull, and say, "It's fine," or "Nothing new," or "I don't want to talk about it."
"Is Josh all right?"
said the second news anchor. "He's fine."
"How do you know?"
Diane did not answer.
"He's going through a lot, Diane,"
said the first co-anchor, and the two co-anchors shared a smile. Was that a smile? "He had a crush on someone, I think, I guess, and it didn't work out," Diane said. She wasn't eating cereal anymore.
"Is that all that's bothering him? Just a failed crush?"
The second co-anchor pushed on, showing at least some background in journalism.
"I don't know. I wish I knew. I don't know. He seems different, or like something has gotten off the rails inside him, and I don't know how to nudge him back. He's been texting in class when he even shows up for class."
"Is he texting a particular person?"
"Not that I was told."
"Definitely check your phone records, Diane,"
the first anchor said, leaning farther over the desk than seemed possible.
"It's a little invasive."
"You're his mother. You are allowed to be invasive as long as he is living under your roof with you paying the bills,"
the second co-anchor said.
"And it's not like you're averse to checking other people's phone records," the other added.
And here the two co-anchors laughed tinnily, with trained rigor, and there was a low rumble felt by many people across Night Vale for the next few seconds.
"I don't think it's just about a crush," said one of the anchors.
"I agree with Tim," said the other.
"Thank you, Trin."
"Last night when I saw him," said Diane, "he was small, about the size of a basketball. And like a basketball, he was round. Unlike a basketball, he was smooth and dark and heavy. I don't know how to talk to him when he's like that."
"You do not know how many parents say that, Diane,"
Tim purred, smiling, eyebrow tilted. There was a rapid clicking sound from the back of Tim's throat, or thorax, as news anchors call it.
"You must be there for him," Trin said.
"But what does that mean? I stand outside his door, I knock. I say, Josh. I say it twice. I tell him there is dinner. I tell him there is television. He says, cool. That's all. Everything is cool. And he stops going to class.
There was a high scream from somewhere in Diane's house, and the sound of a mirror cracking. The refrigerator opened, and a carton of almond milk hit the floor as if it had been slapped off the shelf. It had. The faceless old woman who secretly lives in her home was on one of her rampages again.
Damn it!
Diane rolled her eyes and stood up.
Relax, Diane. The milk is not a disaster. It does not need tending to right away.
Yes, finish your story.
Well, when he does come out of his room, he sits without speaking. His eyes retract. His hair grows long around his hands and feet, silky and straight and soft. His nostrils expand. What am I supposed to say to that? What is the right thing to do?
She sighed, watching the almond milk spread across the floor.
Honestly, there are times when I want to hit him, she said. She had not known she was going to say it.
The co-anchors glanced at each other and shuffled blank papers on their fake desk. The almond milk pooled against the cabinets. She needed to get a paper towel to wipe it up, but didn't feel like she could move.
I mean, I would never do that. I just think it. Does this make me a bad person?
You are only a bad person if you do bad things, said the second anchor.
Thank you.
That's not an acquittal, Diane. The counterpoint is that you are only a good person if you do good things.
Turn off the television and look at this knife I found on eBay, whispered the voice of the faceless old woman over Diane's shoulder.
She turned and looked down the hall, more out of habit than out of interest. It was empty and unnaturally dark. She felt a finger brush her cheek.
The faceless old woman does not like it when people watch television. Diane didn't see her, had never seen her, but she looked down and there was a long hunting knife on the table. It was dull from use, but clean, and otherwise in excellent shape.
It's a nice knife, faceless old woman. Did you get a good deal on it?
No reply. She turned off the television. The anchors remained on screen talking about tornado safety in the desert, and her mind raced with the possibilities of how to better express her love to Josh.
A good person is a person who does good things.
It was a deceptively simple prescription, because it implied that she or anyone else knew what good things are. What could she do in this situation that was good, and by what standard?
She grabbed her phone and typed, Son, I'm sorry I can be difficult. I'm sorry for whatever you are going through, and you don't have to tell me, but I'm your mother, and if there's something we...
She reached the text character limit. Diane does not like sending a single message in multiple texts. She deleted words, she wrote words, she changed the part about not needing to tell her anything to know something about how there are some things mothers need to know about, and if it's a serious prob... Character limit. She deleted things and retyped things. Something about setting aside one night, just one night, an hour even, to talk, even if they just talked about TV shows.
Delete.
Rewrite. Something about knowing how hard it is to be a teenager.
Delete.
Something that started with, how's class, but then devolved into wanting to talk later.
Delete.
Diane stared at her phone. The last text exchange between Josh and her was from a couple of days ago. The final message was her. What time you home? The text before that was also from Diane. Running late, stopping for food, want anything? She scrolled back through her and Josh's texts. A few weeks prior, there was this one from Josh. Sorry, sent to the wrong person. The text before that was Josh on the same date. I definitely want to meet him.
Diane had forgotten this misdirected text. She read it again, with the recent context of his note about meeting a boy.
Invasive, she thinks, when she sees something